That will come up again during work session. But it does mean spreading cost to areas to other fund and federal fund sources, which may prove problematic. That is not part of the governor's budget or not assumed in the governor's budget. Another issue was to evaluate the current staffing and the type of staff for enforcing laws related to tribal gaming. They have made some changes to that. Distribution staff moving away from sworn personnel to more financial and program audit staff, which probably meets the need of the enforcing of the tribal gaming related laws. No significant audit changes. They did, or audit findings by the Secretary of State. They did return to the emergency board, like I mentioned before, in vacant double fill positions. They also received funding, general fund funding for the state sex offender registry, for 10 new evidence techs, which also freed up trooper time out on the road, received funding for 10 new emergency troopers for the patrol division, and at the final e-board, they were provided funding, mainly pass-through funding, most of it for pass-through funding to communities to address gang-related activities. The budget history there is on page 3, or the budget distribution between between the units within the department. There has been significant increase in this budget, but almost all of it is due to the inclusion of the OWIN project. So almost 62% of the total funds budget in the governor's budget for the state police is for the OWIN, including about $485 million of capital construction. So that's one reason this budget has large numbers. On page 4, the major policy and budget issues that I'd like to touch on for you to keep in mind as you go through the budget. This is what I'll call a multifaceted agency in terms of its roles. Some of it is line, like the patrol division or line programs. Other portions of it, like the forensics division, is really supports the entire criminal justice system across the state. In the past, this mixed role has challenged the agency in determining its overall role and its priorities. Currently, there is no 24-hour patrol coverage in the state. The number of troopers, as you're well aware, has fallen dramatically since the early 80s. There's a chart on page 4 that shows the history. It does. The governor's budget does include 139, an increase of, actually a net increase of 138, but 139 troopers, back to about 470. The department did a telephone survey of other states late last year and found they ranked last on true line troopers per capita. If the governor's budget was passed, in its totality, with the 139 new troopers for patrol division, they would increase, so they would be 38. But keep in mind, different states have different sort of police roles for their state police and the size of the sheriffs and the city police departments. So take that with take that into consideration as you look at rankings like that. Regardless, state or Oregon's role in terms of its patrol division does rank at the bottom or near the bottom, almost in every ranking of the number. The governor's budget proposes funding the new troopers and patrol division, as well as 46 existing trooper division or positions in the patrol division, with a new insurance premium surcharge that seems to have a few problems politically at this time, and so at least in the co-chair's budget for the number of new troopers included there, they are using general fund for the new troopers as well as the 46 existing trooper positions. There's about $19.7 million general fund for those positions, compared to zero general fund in the governor's budget. Top of page 5, when staff were cut, including troopers in the patrol division, forensics lab, criminal detectives in 2001-03, at the same time, there were significant cuts in the support functions of the agency, whether it's dispatch, whether it's the fiscal, financial, business services, evidence techs, information management support staff, those kinds of things were also dramatically reduced. The governor's budget does include investments in those areas. It also provides investments in equipment in terms of new digital cameras and recognizes the replacement of two of the field offices, in this case, Bend and at McMinnville. Both of them have significant sort of constraints in either space or the condition of the facility. Owen, even though it's part of the state police budget, they will not spend a great deal of time discussing Owen. That will be dealt as a separate budget issue outside the remainder of the OSP budget. So that still has quite a bit of work to do by both the executive branch and consideration by the legislature before it passes. The budget, the governor's budget, does anticipate the or assume the transfer of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. One of the current responsibilities of the Office of Emergency Management is the 911 system. I just raised the policy issue around whether, since 911 is really a public safety, a day-to-day public safety entity, whether that is the best thing to move to the with the Office of Emergency Management to the military department. So you may want to keep that in the back of your head as you go through the presentation. The governor's budget assumes roughly $40 million in criminal fine and assessment revenues in the budget. The co-chair's budget reverses most of those CFA revenues and backfills in the general fund. It does not have an impact in the overall general fund of the budget for the state as a whole. One of the issues to consider with CFA revenues is, with the exception of 2001-03, CFA revenues have not grown as fast as the general fund, and the more of the CFA you dedicate, the more that you take the chance of some distant out there, a few biennia, of not having enough CFA to support the functions that you want to support with it. And finally, the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force sunsets at the end of this calendar year. There is legislation to extend the sunset, but this subcommittee also had some issues that they were asking questions about the function and some of the activities of that task force. Keep in mind that's a Department of Justice, the State Police, and a Revenue Joint Task Force. And with that, Mr. Chair, those are my presentations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Questions for Representative Nathanson, then Representative Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions for Mr. Wilson. In the notes that you've presented us on page 5, the first paragraph and the last paragraph does provide some information on the governor's budget, including investments in one or other. It doesn't mention in writing what the co-chair's budget did or did not include. Is that because we're still waiting for a little analysis?
They're at the top of page, the two bullets on top of page 5. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In terms of the support staff,
on that purchase of cameras and field offices.
The governor's or the co-chair's budget does not fund at the same level of the governor's budget, but there are still investments for the support services. And at this time, the co-chair's budget continues the tobacco tax compliant task force. But keep in mind that the co-chair's budget, or the co-chairs, anticipate the subcommittee to really work through this, and if they find changes that to their post, to bring them to the co-chairs for consideration.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to Doug, and because you did some communication and did some referencing to 0103 and staff cuts, maybe you can help the committee understand this. From from 99.01 to 0103, the total FTE went from like 1531 to 1506. So we lost 20 some FTE. In that same period, the Office of Emergency Management in 99.01 had a budget of $9 million, and then it went to $60 million. When they had $9 million, they had 39 FTE, and when they went to $60 million, they had 33 FTE. Where did all that money go in that period?
Chair, Representative Hanna, most of that is federal grant money or FEMA monies. It would have been, most of it would have been passed right through to local governments if they administer a number of federal grant programs. So that's probably explained most of it. And I would have to go back and take a look.
Okay.
And I think that would explain the bulk of it.
Okay, follow up. Just, and again, you referenced the cuts to that time period. And we've just explained a big chunk of that. I mean, $51 million. The entire budget grew by $58 million in the time period mentioned. Was part of the difference here FTE authority versus actual hired officers? Because the FTE authority, you know, went down slightly, or the FTE total went down only slightly while the budget actually went up. So the difference is drastic in authority, but not troopers?
Chair, Representative, I'd have to go back. I don't recall. I know what chart you're looking at. I'd have to go back and take a look at it. I don't recall right offhand, so I'll try to do that and get back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, another note. Keep in mind that a lot of those cuts happened late in the 0103 biennial because of all the special sessions and those kinds of things. So FTE does vary in the timing of when the staff is cut.
But the point that you bring up, I want to make sure that we do have a responsive answer to your question as we go through this at some point. So thank you for bringing that forward, Representative Hanna.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
The question I brought up earlier in the previous testimony here when we started this was
Let's get this out of the way.
has nothing to do with water. It's the rollout cost, not the roll-up cost. I mean, if we hire these many troopers, what's going to be the cost with indigent defense, police station, judges, patrol, anything? Are we going to be dwelling into that particular thing, or are we just going to
cost
hire
your
troopers?
Cost in Umatilla County.
Yeah. is that going to be part of our analysis? What is it going to cost us all the way through the system? Because my sense is there is going to be a rollout cost. And if I remember the testimony, it was, well, if we did it right, it would be an initial cost, and eventually it would be a lower cost. But then there's the assumption, are we doing it right? So,
well, if I could take a stab at it before you do, I think, a couple of things. One, I think we'll be involved in preventing a fair amount of crime from happening, the more troopers who are on the street, because it'll be kind of a deterrent effect for other speeders. But, and I think the other thing is that we can take a look at history where there's been an increase in troopers, how the other parts of the system.
It's my sense that the State Highway Patrol is putting a lot of their emphasis on drug traffic right now. At least the trip that I took around, my ride around, was, my sense was they were looking for meth guys and people that were transporting drugs, and just the speeders. And so you start picking those people up, there is going to be a cost in the system at some particular time. They're doing a very good job of it. So it's not only speeding is what I'm looking at. I just think that the whole function of the state police is much, much bigger. And I think there are going to be rollout costs.
Fair enough. Senator Wesson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, do you have any idea when we are going to get the budget detail for all of the public safety budgets from the co-chairs? Because the reason I asked that, I mean, we're starting to look at budget numbers here, and obviously we go as far as governors recommended, and I think this is part of Representative Nathanson's question, is, we're looking at this stuff, and we're kind of getting anxious to do budgets. We've been sitting here seeing overviews for 3 months. It's time to get down to the nitty-gritty here, and I know I will rue those words now that they're said soon enough. But the other thing is just in terms of the larger overall being able to put into perspective when we're weighing certain needs of state police versus DOC versus, you know, judicial system versus DOJ, we've got to have that complete overview. I mean, I know there's a bill going around now that might have some merit for state police funding, that it really is difficult to make an assessment of not knowing the rest of the picture. And it's, you know, I mean, we're kind of operating in a vacuum here. So a simple question articulated way too longly is just, do we know when we're going to get this budget detail that we all need to operate?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's been kind of rolled out slowly to the chairs as well, but if I think I'll pass that on to Mr. Wilson, see if he has any insight into that.
Mr. Chair,
he is learning. He's past, yeah.
At this time, we're not spending a lot of time or sharing a lot of the detail with agencies as well as others. I think that may be a question to pose to the co-chairs on when they plan to do. Of course, we will be, if we're given the green light, we'll be very willing to sit down with folks and go through it.
In the meantime, I've been given at least kind of the outlines of some of the policy option packages and I've scheduled appointments with each of you over the next couple of days and to find out some of your interest moving forward as well as to discuss those option packages as well. Any other questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm new to this process, but I guess I want to follow up on a couple of my colleagues' points here. We're being asked to look at budgets. We have a governor's recommended budget. We've got some details from a co-chair's recommended budget that said we were going to be, you know, making those decisions here in the subcommittee's allocation. But if there's already a recommended allocation from the co-chairs, it certainly would be nice to have that before we go and spend a lot of time listening to a lot of information that there's already another direction that people would have input to. So I just want to echo my thoughts on that, that it would be great if we had that information today.
Fair enough. Duly noted. Why don't we get started? Superintendent McLean.
Mr. Chair, members, I draw your attention to the packet in front of you with the rubber band, which is their presentation packet.
Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Timothy McLean, Superintendent of State Police. Seated at the table with me is Monica Brown, our budget office, and Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Wilson's referred you to the handout we provided. And, Mr. Chair, if I could just go over the schedule here real briefly. Tomorrow we have invited testimony. It'll be two sheriffs and a chief. And then on Monday we have invited testimony. That'll be just a district attorney to talk about the crime labs. And that's the only invited testimony we have. Other than that, we're pretty flexible. So the next several days, 12 members of the state police will provide the committee testimony in the department's various programs. 12 may be seen as a lofty number to present a single agency's budget, but I felt because of the department's diverse responsibility, it's important for the committee to hear from division experts. Their testimony will focus on budget drivers, program efficiencies, policy option package, and performance targets. For today, I'd like to provide testimony on our interim budget notes and actions taken by the emergency board, our recruiting efforts, the vision for the department and how it relates to the proposed budget, Then Monica Brown will provide an overview of the agency's budget. Following Monica, I've asked one of our region captains to appear before the committee, provide testimony as to the field perspective in regards to the policy package and what those mean to the men and women in the field offices. That commander would be Travis Hampton, seated behind me. And if time permits, we will kickstart a division presentation by having Captain Jerry Gregg of the Patrol Division up first. Mr. Chair, during the interim, State Police reported to the Emergency Board on several budget notes and received additional funding for sworn and professional staff. With your permission, I'll take a few minutes to provide an update to the subcommittee. In your handout, if you please refer to Appendix C, page 1. This is Mr. Wilson's stated already. This doesn't include all the budget notes that we reported to the Emergency Board. The first one is the Evidence Technician Program, as Mr. Wilson's already reported on. The Legislative Emergency Board recognized the need for dedicated employees to ensure that the evidence is collected, maintained, and disposed of properly. Utilizing 10 civilian employees allowed our troopers and sergeants who were performing these duties part-time to return to their focus to transportation safety. To date, the evidence techs have worked over 12,000 hours managing evidence, logged in over 10,000 exhibits, and properly disposed of evidence from 3,800 backlog cases. During the patrol presentation, testimony will be provided on Policy Package 101, which restores additional evidence techs and field support positions. In January 2006, 10 additional troopers positions were also funded by the E-Board. They were hired on May 1, 2006, completed 22 weeks of training and approximately 3 weeks of training with a coach, and they are now on solo patrol. Per a budget note, Tribal Gaming Section evaluated their staffing level, which resulted in 5 sworn positions being reclassified to governmental auditor number 1 positions. To date, 3 of the 5 position transfers are completed. And of special note, 1 trooper transferred back to patrol division and is helping fill the patrol and public needs by working his shifts on the Sunny M Pass and has been extremely helpful in keeping the pass open during our winter conditions. Vacancy report. You can see from the report we had 40 vacancies as of March 5th, 2007. Since that date, I've received 3 additional retirement notices from sworn personnel. Most recent hires have been on January 8th, 2007. We hired 12 recruits. To date, 3 have resigned, and the remaining 9 are at Newark Police Academy and will graduate in May of this year. In a minute, I'll report on our efforts in recruiting and hiring. And last,
just a moment, Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, would you give us a quick synopsis? What's your feeling so far of the smaller recruit classes being integrated into DPSST, i.e., these folks that you, the 10 that you hired? And I'm making the assumption, I think I'm right, that they went to the new training.
Chair Shields, Representative Hannon, that's correct. Yes, I did. And at this point, it's working excellent.
Great.
And last is the methamphetamine and gang-related grants. Might have a little typo there, G-R-A-N-G, that were funded by the November 2006 E-Board. We should be within days of having all the signatures on the non-competitive grants, and within a week of having the request for proposals for the competitive grants. Moving on to recruiting and hiring.
Just want to give a thank you to the superintendent and the troopers, because they are part of our Marion County strike force, meth strike force that is, I think, unique. And they're working very diligently to go after the bigger meth dealers and manufacturers in this community. And I just want to thank you for your staff who was working with the district attorney and the Marion County Sheriff and the city police, and we have three other cities that's involved in the strike force. And I just have to say thanks, because it's a concerted effort by all the law enforcement community to rid our communities of the methamphetamine epidemic.
Senator Reiner, thank you.
And those cities are the other cities that are involved?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
The other cities that are involved, Superintendent?
The other cities on the grant program,
yeah.
As far as this most recent one, we have Canby, Gresham, and the Marion County.
Okay.
And then the other one will go out for competitive bid there, so to speak.
Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
It's all right. I got a bit of a cold.
Chair, I think you need to go home. Sound like I did last week.
It's occurred to me.
Your work is just beginning.
That's the only person.
I
wasn't always sure if there'd be somebody to hear, though. Please continue.
Today, Mr. Chair. He's been giving remonstrances about that.
Mr. Chair, it could be my hearing loss, and also the big font kind of comes with that too. So, recruiting and hiring. One of the common questions asked since the announcement of the governor's recommended budget is, can state police hire the 139 patrol troopers, 12 detectives, and fill approximately 40 vacancies created by retirements within a two-year period? My initial answer is, we look forward to the challenge. But we all know that's not an adequate answer. Recruiting, hiring, and retaining qualified police applicants, problem recognized statewide. Trends show agencies are hiring and retaining qualified police officers not by lowering the standard, but by offering lateral transfers, competitive salary, through a constant recruiting program. State police has not actively recruited since 2003, so our first step was to temporarily assign two troopers, one from patrol and one from Fish and Wildlife Division, as full-time recruiters. Their job is to find qualified applicants and work towards increasing the numbers of female and minority applicants. They are to accomplish their mission by attending job fairs, field trips to colleges and military bases in the Northwest, and attendance at community events. Not only do they recruit for the trooper candidates, but they look for qualified applicants to fill positions in our crime labs and dispatch centers. During the administrative services presentation, the committee will hear a testimony on policy package 207, which addresses our training and recruiting needs. Also, there's more detail as far as our recruiting efforts if the committee needs it. The next step was to address our lateral policy. For years, state police has hired other certified officers to fill vacant positions. However, they were expected to attend our 22-week recruit school. This requirement limited the number of experienced officers that applied for state police. 2 months ago, we changed our policy. A new policy will allow certified officers with 3 years' experience to apply, and if hired, they will attend a 4-week state police orientation school and then immediately report to a field office in an assignment as a patrol trooper, fish and wildlife trooper, or detective. Based on their level of experience, some level of advanced training will be required. Salary will be based on their years of experience. To date, without a statewide of announcement, we have received over 48 applications from certified officers within Oregon and out of state. The last hurdle to clear was a plan to ensure we can meet deadlines. Captain Marquis, Fish and Wildlife Division, was put on point, and with the assistance of talented staff, they developed a plan you will find under the Administrative Service tab, fourth page in. Pull out, titled OSP Project 200. Senator Burdick, I believe you had questions during the agency overview, and I probably didn't do the best of job and as far as asking questions about our number of weeks of training. This might be helpful. Just to briefly describe what this is, In the gray area, we're at the top left, you can see Albany, Pendleton, and Medford. Those would be our testing sites and dates. We figure that we need roughly 600 applicants to generate about 40 qualified recruits. In the dark green, then, is a selection of background review time, and that's where we take the 600, and the average has been, again, roughly 600 or 40 recruits from that 600 applicants. The blue is our four-week hire pre-academy, what I refer to as the State Police Orientation Academy, and then straight into the DPSST 16-week academy. The light green indicates that's the FTO. That would be their field training time, which is roughly 3 months. And then the orange is their advanced academy, where they would get instruction in such areas of crash investigation, fish and wildlife laws, commercial vehicle laws, first aid, just to name a few. We found that, as referred to this OSP Project 200, if say we were to hire 200 in 2 year period of time, we found if it was just recruits, we would not be able to reach that goal. In order for this plan to work, we have to have the lateral transfers. And in order for us to reach that 200 mark, we'd have to have at least 30 laterals. Now, of course, if we got more than 30, as I said, we have 48 that have already submitted applications, then that would shorten this whole process up. Again, there's more detail available here. The staff worked in conjunction with DPSST staff to make sure this plan would work, and there was also some, they developed all the cost associated with this. As you know, we have moved from Camp Rialia, and even we were originally going to have our four-week pre-academy up at Camp Rialia. We've now been able to work that out with the academy staff, and we moved it down here, which I believe the cost factor is about $114,000 in savings, not just from the rent up there, but from the factor of staff from other parts of the state traveling to Camp Rialia to provide training to new officers.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
On these lateral transfers, where do they come from, generally speaking?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, for the most part, they're city police officers, deputy sheriffs. Some of the early applications that we've got, some folks seem to have an interest in fish and wildlife position. Some would like to work in other parts of the state. And some, quite frankly, would like to come on a board because we pay a better salary than some agencies, particularly on the east side of in the east side of the state.
Mr. Chair, are we getting any lateral? Because before we had those horrible budget cuts, a lot of our highly trained officers went to other jobs in Washington State. Are we getting any of those back?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, this is from memory, but of the 132 we laid off, we got back right around probably a little over 100 of those officers that went to other locations. Some, as you know, because it came immediately back to us, and then others, trying to think again from memory, the last one I probably hired back was 8-9 months ago. I had made a decision, wanted to come back and be a state trooper. We have had some interest since we put this new lateral transfer thing out from some of those members that did go up north to other agencies, so we may still get a few of those back.
And to follow up one last time, and when you get them back, there's no further training costs that you have to incur. They're ready to roll without any other training costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, there may be, depending on what job they've held. In this case, one of the officers, I think the latest one I've heard that expressed an interest to come back, is working for the Fish and Wildlife Department up north in Washington. And if we were to bring him back in a patrol position, he would probably need additional training or refresher training in such laws as DUII, those type.
Thank you.
Superintendent McLean, so the hiring schedule that you have here corresponds roughly with the amount of money in the governor's recommended budget. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. That's good. Okay.
Talk a few minutes about vision. By 2011, I want the State Police to be recognized as a premier leader in public safety. I believe that the State Police is full of leaders, but because of issues outside our control, we've slipped from being a first-class operation. It's only because of our employees that people still see our work as top-notch, but citizens and our partners cannot always count on us to be there. This proposed budget is the first of many steps for State Police towards reestablishing ourselves in the greater criminal justice system. The roadmap to this vision is our ability to communicate the value of not just adding patrol troopers, but what the benefit is adding trades, maintenance workers, dispatchers, evidence technicians, forensic scientists, or wireless technicians. It is maximizing our service to the public and assistance to our public safety partners. It is our ability to manage traffic and emergency incidents by working with ODOT and our public safety partners. We will improve departmental efficiencies by continuously looking for ways to increase the effectiveness of our operation. We must focus on our core mission and responsibilities and be cautious about accepting new missions without an increase in resources. Just, again, a few minutes here on budget development, and I'll, if there's no questions, I'll turn it over to Monica. In preparing our 2007-2009 budget, the department developed a new approach to identifying our priorities and the level of service expected of the agency. During 2006, we held open meetings with stakeholders and partners to gain input as we developed our strategic business plan. We also gained input from a customer service survey, which was mailed to our partners and registered voters. The customer survey has been included in our key performance measures. Both documents were provided during the agency overview. And thank you to Representative Hannah for being a part of our planning sessions. To prepare for the 2009-2011 budget, the department will take the same approach to the next level by holding meetings statewide involving our employees, partners, and the public we serve. This budget is a very important management tool that will allow our agency to plan, control, and deploy State Police resources effectively and meet the expectations of our citizens, public safety partners, and policymakers. It is critical for our agency to deliver first-class services and be there when called upon by the citizens or our partners in public safety. Mr. Chair, if there's no immediate questions, I'll have Monica provide an overview of the budget.
Yes, dear.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, for the record, Monica Brown, Budget Director for OSP.
Let me get that over there. Sorry.
I believe in referencing the memo provided by the Legislative Fiscal Office provides a great deal of the detail on many of the initiatives in the governor's budget, so I will just cover items very high level. I'll direct your attention to the first tab referenced as Budget Overview. For comparison purposes, these numbers reflect the agency's budget minus the Owen project, which will be addressed separately, and reflects the transfer of Oregon Emergency Management, which you received testimony on from the military department. So on page one behind that tab, you will see a reflection of the agency's budgets, all funds by divisions. Again, the largest division that we have is patrol, representing almost 36% of the total resources. The governor's recommended budget reflects approximately 12.5% increase over the essential budget level. On page two, you see a reflection of the revenue sources in the agency's budget. Again, this is very high level. You will notice that general fund and lottery fund resources in this agency reflects a total of 46% of the total resources. Other funds account for almost 50% of the total resources. Two-thirds of those other funds come from the criminal fines and assessment account, as mentioned earlier, the proposed auto insurance surcharge, state fire marshal taxes and fees, and fish and wildlife charges for services. There are other minor sources of revenue, other funds throughout the agency, but those are the ones that make up the bulk of that. On page three.
Senator Nelson.
Question, are the lottery funds, are that major 66 funds?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, yes, they are 100% Measure 66, and they support Fish and Wildlife Division.
That's the $7 million.
Yes.
The reason I ask that is in the Natural Resource Committee, that's a big issue as to whether or not this is actually Measure 66 fund, so I just thought I'd bring it to the
right.
Chair's attention.
On page 3, again, you will see just the general fund and lottery resources to see the allocation across the agency. Again, patrol is receiving the lion's share of the general fund and lottery fund resources. Page 4 is an allocation by expenditure category. You will see personal service dollars drive almost two-thirds of the total budget. Service and supplies, roughly 24%. The largest line item expenditures within services and supplies is facilities and related utilities and maintenance of $17.5 million, state government service charge of $14.7 million. A little less than 5% of the total budget is for capital outlay, most of which it goes for vehicle replacements. And a very small portion is in special payments, largely out of federally funded special payments to locals. Table 5 is a historical perspective.
Yeah, Representative. Thank you, Chairman. Monica, if you could just, I'm just trying to reconcile a couple of numbers as we're going through, and
sure.
I'm sure you will at some point in time. Patrol on the first slide on page 1, $116 million. And yet our total general fund and lottery funds only provide $77 million for that $116. In the governor's budget, where's the other, I guess, $40 million coming from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the first slide is all funds. The $77 million represented on page 3 is only the general fund and lottery. So the
Correct.
Auto insurance surcharge is approximately $25 million of that. Contracts with Department of Transportation for various things such as seatbelt enforcement, dually enforcement, construction zone, I think total roughly $6 million. The other various sources escape me, but there's several other contracts for services, intergovernmental agreements in there.
Mr. Chair, others include the legislature and Department
yes.
of Administrative Services for the
Capitol Mall.
Capitol Mall.
We'll see, excuse me, Mr. Chair, we'll see that someplace in the detail.
They may address it, or if you want me, I'll list some more of those out. But if you look at in this document, which I handed out, each division has a revenue source section, which does summarize the revenue sources, and then maybe the detail you need may be there.
Okay.
In each of the divisions are listed there.
And Mr. Thank Chair, you. Representative Cameron, I will notice there's one very large document that is at the table. Each of you should have a copy of the full spreadsheets that outlines by line item, fund source, by division. We can get you a summary, but that document is available to each member as well.
Thank you very much.
Back to page 5, the table and the chart there. Again, just a historical perspective. Back to 9901, again, the agency comparison excluding OEM and the Owen project. The thing to note here that causes some concern when they first see the number is the change in general fund. Again, that reduction is largely reflective of the governor's proposals to support part of the patrol division through an auto insurance surcharge, but it also reflects a shift from the general fund to criminal fines and assessments, which would be other funds in our budget, for forensics, the medical examiner, and criminal justice information services. So in total, the governor's recommended budget actually includes $8.8 million in investments from the general fund for the agency. Just by way of summary, starting on page 7, you will notice each of the agency's policy packages agency-wide that presents by fund source and category of expenditure. So that's there for your reference. The divisions, when they are up making their presentations, they will go through their portions of the policy packages individually. And then I will also draw your attention to Appendix A in your handouts. As part of the statewide budget development process, we were required to develop a prioritized list of services. Those of you that were on Ways and Means last year or last session would be familiar with this list. So that's available for your reference, as well as the 10% reduction options that are required for it.
Thank you.
of the budget development process are also there for your reference. With that, Mr. Chair, that concludes my summary remarks.
Thank you very much. Questions? Let's keep rolling.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to bring up Captain Travis Hampton. Travis has 17 years' experience with us. He's worked in all three operational divisions, and he's been assigned from the coast to Portland, and now to the east side of the mountain.
Yeah, thank you. Captain Hampton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is one of my top five scary experiences in my 17 years.
Mine too.
Mine is when I get picked up and I one of these fellows come around.
Hey, Cameron, where are the other four? Come on.
You can stop by hymns there. Captain Hampton, you'll find that we're only slightly more antisocial than most of the people you face.
Thanks for warning. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. My name is Travis Hampton, for the record. I have the honor of serving our agency as one of our department's three field commanders at the rank of captain. I'm currently stationed in Bend, where I supervise 16 Central and Eastern Oregon counties. My goal today is to provide testimony from the perspective of a sworn supervisor, a police officer for our department, importing the priority importance of bolstering our support services, service base, and or agency infrastructure. We appreciate the support for our police officers, but as a police officer, I just wanted to impart the importance of the non-sworn part of our department also, as we attempt to provide public safety services throughout Oregon. Today, it is evident the organization's shared goal of public safety within our state cannot be obtained by the uniformed officer alone, but it is a shared responsibility. This shared responsibility, of course, includes, of course, all levels of government, the citizens, and elected officials, but also at a very diverse Department of State Police. You've heard from Superintendent McLean outlining the department's mission and the summary of our major enforcement divisions, investigative, and record management divisions. You'll hear testimony from my peer group who work here in our agency's general headquarters in Salem, detailing the functions of the respective divisions in much more detail than I could hope to cover. And I hope you save the very hard questions for them when they testify subsequent to me. We all know that police services are a people business, with staffing costs dictating the operating budget. The cornerstone of our state police is our personnel, although we are challenged with maintaining financial stability while adapting to policing and community needs, a challenge that we are still committed to meet, though. I feel this is a privilege to be asked by the superintendent to come represent our field force, the men and women that I work with, who, as I speak, are actively engaged in protecting the citizens of Oregon, our property, and our natural resources. Unfortunately, past budget constraints have not cut only into the face of our department, the uniform contingent, but the multitude of support service employees that keep us uniformed troopers on patrol. When I first took a moment of what I might say to you today, a number of themes crossed my mind. How can I impart the challenges and rewards of working for as a state trooper in the field? And so I decided on a relatively simple example. I just took a simple desk log entry from the Bend Area Command, which is a command group that patrols Crook, Jefferson, and Deschutes County. And I just want to give you an example where the rubber meets the road, what I deal with on a daily basis when I don't have the support staff to do the job. Madras Police Department a few weeks back notifies our dispatch center that they're in pursuit of some fugitives that have run from police in the past and got away. These are the real bad guys, the real McCoy, and they ask for our assistance. They're heading south out of into Deschutes County from Jefferson County, and we have two troopers in en route to intercept this vehicle as it approaches the county line. The suspect vehicle attempts to avoid spike strips laid out by troopers and deputies at the Deschutes County line. The suspect loses control of the vehicle and drives through a farmer's field and becomes stuck. One of the troopers that's pursuing the vehicle secures his patrol vehicle, gives chase. After a brief struggle, he captures, with the assistance of law enforcement from city and county, the two suspects that ran from the vehicle. This is probably what we would consider a success story. Bad guys are caught. It's got a small blurb in our local Bend bulletin, and we think, you know, great, we had troopers working that day, and the bad guys are caught. I just want to talk about what else goes on behind the scenes after this fairly typical arrest is made. Like I mentioned before, we have the uniformed patrol trooper, the one dressed like me today, who's driving a marked car on our state interstate freeways and state highways. We were fortunate we had a trooper on duty when the city requested assistance. I say we're fortunate because nowhere in the state do we have 24-hour coverage. A problem that has intensified where I work in rural Oregon, where city and county police departments have their own staffing constraints and issues they're dealing with right now. In 2006 alone, OSP received over 26,000 time-sensitive calls for service. Now, those aren't all calls. Time-sensitive are calls that we would deem immediate cover calls for service, our agency and others. Your husbands and wives call, phone a drunk driver on I-5, 205. They need backup, reckless driver. Those 26,000 time-sensitive calls, there's just nobody to respond to them at all. The second trooper I mentioned in my little scenario is one of our department's Fish and Wildlife Division troopers, who in a moment's notice switched gears from his primary assignment as a steward of our state's natural resources to a fully functional backup trooper. These Fish and Wildlife troopers, even though they're assigned to rural patrol, have the same core training that our patrol division troopers have, and in a moment's notice, he's heading into the fray, into the pursuit. This trooper is working in Crook County, heads west into Deschutes County in an effort to intercept this vehicle. I mention this because one trooper is driving a car, the patrol division trooper, one's driving a pickup, both pushing their vehicles to their safe limits, hopefully having the confidence they have adequate tires, their hoses, brakes inspected on their vehicles. This is important to me because in central and eastern Oregon, we don't employ fleet managers to take care of our vehicles anymore in all 16 counties. This task, the basic care and maintenance of our motor vehicles, left up to the sworn officer. This is truly something that I can accomplish, but every hour I, as a patrol trooper, spend at Oil Can Henry's or at Le Schwab's, that's one less hour that I'm on patrol. And we're just, quite frankly, not doing the job we're trained to perform. On one end of the spectrum, the loss of fleet workers to many of our field offices is a waste of efficiencies. The other end, for many of our troopers driving vehicles in excess of 100,000 miles, we mile ours out of 120,000 miles, without proper maintenance, this is a safety issue for us, and it crosses your mind when you're traveling at high speeds, when you're pushing a car that probably should have been turned in several thousand miles ago, knowing that you've been charged with the care and maintenance of this vehicle, and it's really a reactive maintenance. Something breaks, I take it in. We don't have the people anymore that actually look for problems in your vehicle. Crack rims, frame rails, I mean, these cars are abused, they're put to the test. You know, this is particularly important in our department and nationwide because vehicle-related incidents account for the bulk of our officers' deaths. I think 9 or 10 of our 27 killed in line of duty have been vehicle-type incidents, not just the bad guys on the road. Getting back to our chase, Jefferson and Deschutes County, they operate on separate radio frequencies, so OSP Communications assumes the primary responsibility of updates for our troopers and the other officers in the pursuit. Now we're in the hands of our State Police Information Management Division, who you'll hear more about this later, who deliver information and communication services to our staff and our customers. The troopers relay the car information and the plate to our dispatch center via radio, and immediately our dispatcher will check the plate to see if it's stolen. In this case, we already knew it was, through our law enforcement data system, or LEDs, to see if the car is stolen, if the operator has warrants for their arrest. That's routine. This is also a product of our information management division. This information, because deputies in city are on different frequencies, our dispatcher can relay that information immediately right to their 911 centers, and so we're all on the same page. Like we mentioned earlier, the car becomes stuck, and the trooper jumps out of his car and turns his portable radio on in the foot chase, giving updates to officers and deputies responding to the scene from three different counties now. Hopefully, once again, the trooper exits the car with confidence that the dispatch center on the other end doesn't have a dispatcher that is inadequately trained or maybe working their second shift, that person's paying attention to what they say, and you know their care is really in this person's hand. On the other end of the spectrum, we have portable radio that I mentioned clicking on the knob. This becomes a really fancy paperweight when our radios aren't functioning. This is your lifeline. And in Deschutes County, where I work primarily, it's not uncommon for our radios to go down for hours, sometimes days at a time, where troopers are forced to burn 911 centers, go to neighboring OSP frequencies in Wasco County or down in Lake County. It's not ideal. And it's a huge issue for these troopers working patrol.
Captain Hampton, can I ask you a question about something that jumped out at me in your testimony?
Yes, Mr.
You said that the majority of trooper deaths are related to vehicle safety issues. Is that what you're
saying? There's many officer deaths. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Protocol.
No.
Nationwide vehicle deaths account for a large percentage, and I don't want to mislead that, you know, our cars are breaking down or we're dying, but the bulk of officer deaths come from car crashes. Not the bulk, but many of them come from car crashes, getting struck by other vehicles when you're on traffic stops. So the vehicle aspect of policing is very, very important to me and to the troopers. In the last 30 months, I put 100,000 miles on my car. That's your office. You live in it. What you would call an administrative person, you can imagine the miles a trooper's putting on their shift that's patrolling rural Oregon, especially 300-400 miles a shift is not uncommon. Mm-hmm. Tell you when it's working. At 100 miles an hour, 120, everything's intensified and amplified. The brakes aren't maintained, hoses, and they break down, and they crash.
And then follow up, so have there been concerns around vehicle safety? Is that something that you have some leverage over with management, or how does that work?
Well, sorry, I don't want to step on toes, Mr. Chair, but the vehicles are a huge concern. I mean, Captain Gray could testify about vehicles, patrol cars, Crown Victorias, 90,000 miles, industry standard, maybe less in some states, that they recycle cars. We push ours to 120. That's when we think about turning them in. And by then, these are not the cars that, you know, were driven by your grandmother on Sunday. They've all been wrecked. They've been damaged. They've had chain brake loose and damaged undercarriage. I mean, they've been patrolled. They've been used. But that comes with a dollar figure. To buy more cars and recycle them at lower miles, it costs a lot of money.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. When I rode around with the trooper, he mentioned this very same thing. It was Dan Chichester. And he was saying that he thought that DAS had something to do with it. Does DAS make the decision as to how many miles you're supposed to be traveling on these things or how many you're supposed to be using that? I don't know if I got that right from him or not. But
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, no. We've made that determination. We would stretch the life of these cars out. We don't have the money to replace them at times. I came on in 1979, I believe we capped them out at 80, and then we went to 90,000.
Thank you.
Okay, let's continue. Back to our little scenario here. The suspects are caught in this case, although one is wounded and requires first aid to treat a cut from barbed wire fence. This is treatment our troopers are adequately trained to provide as medic first responders. We have a little bit higher level of medic training than some officers do in the state. And that may not be that important to those working in Southeast Portland where you're always secondary to the ambulance, but the people that work where I work, sometimes you beat the ambulance, and it's nice to have that training. Fortunately, in this case, the suspect chose to discard the gun he was carrying, so the only wound we treated that day was a cut from a barbed wire fence, nothing more serious. After the suspects are on their way to jail, the trooper locates the typical drug evidence, stolen mail and checks you find in the cars of all bad guys. This fine, although they may take a police officer, or in this case a trooper, off the road for several days to properly identify victims' identity theft, where the mail come from, how are these citizens harmed. We have no detectives assigned to our Madras office where this trooper works. So a phone call went into our Bend patrol office to request a detective to handle this tedious task of going through stolen mail and identity. The case was accepted by one of only two detectives we have working in the Tri-County area. Actually, these detectives are assigned to Fort County, County and Wheeler. And these are part of our Criminal Investigative Services Division, our detective branch, which you'll hear more about that. But this identity theft case would fall into line with officer-involved shootings, multi-county sexual physical abuse investigations, homicide investigations. You can see where this would fall in the priority line. If it's my ID, it's a big deal, but in this detective's caseload, it's going to fall in the line and maybe be neglected for more than a couple days. The patrol division trooper seizes the relevant items and logs them into temporary evidence at the Madras office, awaiting retrieval by the detective. in my 16 counties. I mentioned that I'm charged with supervising. I only have two evidence custodians in those 16 counties, one in Pendleton, one in Bend. The two evidence technicians in Central and Eastern Oregon are charged with the proper handling, maintaining, disposition of evidence, but unfortunately this job is done by sworn officers in most cases. Usually that's the role of a sergeant, who unfortunately, instead of being on the road doing the line-level task of supervising and enforcing the law, they're handling evidence in the bulk of my work sites. This time-consuming function, like our fleet maintenance work, presents a great deal of personal and professional liability if not conducted properly. The restoration of evidence managers to our larger patrol offices would greatly improve the efficiency of our police personnel. Returning the rough equivalent of one full-time trooper or sergeant back to patrol with placement of each evidence technician. The final field function of this police chase is the documentation of the arrest in the report form for the eventual statistical documentation and criminal prosecution. Currently, less than half the field posts I supervise have assigned clerical staff to handle the administrative workload for our officers. This inefficiency burdens our officers with printing, copying, mailing of enforcement documents after they are authored in many of our work sites. Only six in those 16 counties have actual clerical staff to perform this function. The data entry for this enforcement product is done by the larger offices that have assigned staff, although this backlog of our professional staff may delay the entry of data, enforcement data, for months on our citations, which in the policing field is a wealth of knowledge to have. Cars that are stopped, where they were going, who was driving them. In addition to the data entry, these non-sworn professional staff personnel are handling calls from the public, registering and monitoring thousands of our state sex offenders, releasing towed vehicles, processing admin paperwork, and transitioning our enforcement product to the respective DAs, county courts. Kind of wrap this up for you. I hope this is a fairly typical police action that you understand. This happens daily. And I just want to draw, give a perspective on how well these divisions and the support staff reinforce one another, and by great extent are mutually complementary and dependent on one another. I try to shy away from a grandiose shootout or a manhunt or a dramatic murder investigations, although we do these too. I mean, just watch the news, you can see that these come up. You can imagine the support staff that would take to handle an incident of this magnitude. I wanted to give a policing example that happens from day in and day out. It probably happened somewhere in the state with my agency and the time it took me to read this testimony. I guess in closing, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, we don't have the troopers, as we all know, to provide protection to much of our state during many hours of the day. The budget that increases our sworn ranks is essential if we're hoping to maintain around-the-clock coverage. This is an investment in our state's future, benefiting not only the state of our current officers, but the safety of our citizens and the visitors to our magnificent state. We have seen a return on an investment in our sworn ranks from previous budgets through increased staff deployment and associated community satisfaction. I can't sit here in front of you today and tell you that by giving us 24-hour patrol coverage, it does not come with an absolute guarantee of safety to our citizens. Although I think it is the first responsible step and a relatively basic human desire of helping our fellow citizens and protecting them from those that mean us harm. The state police have a 75-year record of success when given the resources to combat Oregon's policing challenges. As I mentioned earlier, the troopers are working without adequate radio communication, an issue that honestly causes me to lose sleep at night. They have to have a consistent mechanism to receive calls for service and a dependable tool to call for help when they need it. Our radios, our primary means of communication, like I mentioned earlier, routinely go down for hours, sometimes for days. Quite frankly, for many years, our department has lived with communication safety practices that should be viewed as totally unacceptable. An increase in facility and infrastructure improvements for our agency is viewed by me as an urgent need. We need the non-sworn support staff personnel to keep the men and women in uniform on patrol doing the jobs you hired us to do. An investment in professional, technical, fleet workers, and evidence technicians will allow our sworn ranks to meet their intended potential. I think adding sworn personnel without an investment in our non-sworn ranks would only erode our good intentions in the long run. Now, like I mentioned earlier, I truly appreciate the opportunity to represent our field staff as you consider our consider our budget, but cannot express our stress, how seriously stretched we are within the field operations, as you know, in the sworn but also the non-sworn ranks. They are quite frankly stretched to the point of a snap, in my personal opinion, and it will adversely affect our ability to deliver quality public safety services in Oregon. Thank you. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Captain. Good testimony, and really appreciate you coming in to do that. On the cars, with this new budget, are you going to be able, maybe you and Superintendent can answer, going to be able to move those miles down? I mean, I know, I believe anyway, that cars are much better than they were when you and I got started. So in those days, we had to get rid of the cars at an earlier age. But 120,000 miles on a patrol car seems to me to be way too much, because for people that don't know, you get, especially if it's a car that's out pretty much three shifts, you have three different drivers, which is always harder on a car anyway. But then patrol is just, I remember meeting my pickup truck to death, losing shock absorbers at times, and the regular patrol cars on the freeway just run about 300 miles a day on I-5. But I see a lot full of Dodge Chargers, which I know the guys would love to have out there on the street. Are those going to be? You're going to be able to move those out a little quicker with this budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, yes, we are, and we'll be able to drive down that mileage, I believe, too. Patrol Division will have probably a better report on that, but this budget does include a one-to-one car ratio, which would be very helpful. Instead of, as you said, the car being rotated through several officers, a couple of things there, as you would know, the car tends to be taken care of better when one officer drives it. He's aware of the car better, not to mention brand, but you did bring up the Charger, but we are, too, having issues with one particular make of car. We've had some rim issues here lately where the rims have split apart. We had to pay out of our own pocket, I believe, to the tune of about $40,000, although the captain can probably give you the exact figure, just to replace the rims on a 2004 version of that make. We had one crash down in the Roseburg area that we nearly lost an officer from that crash.
And then just another, I mean, without wanting to really dwell on this, we had a Senate Bill 400, which would allow the troopers to bargain over safety issues. And I see some of these things you're telling us that it would really, in my opinion, it would be great if they could be able to take that to the some of those issues to the bargaining table. I understand money and all that, but I'll just let it go up there. I don't want to beat that horse anymore.
I'll beat it for a while. Would you like to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I'd really like to have the opportunity to provide it to him, the equipment to him, without going to the bargaining table.
Fair enough. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Hampton, thank you. I appreciate you being here. You talk about scary. It's not often we actually have somebody with a gun talking to us. So, all right. You know, it goes both ways. You mentioned a little bit out of the area that you command, I think, is Pendleton and Bend. And I'm wondering, because you talked about the evidence technician program, how were your two field offices impacted by the 10 additional evidence technicians that were added by the emergency board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, it's been a huge impact for my operation. Ideally, all five of our area commands would receive evidence techs, which you'll hear more about that later, but I can go beyond saying that it's returned one full-time officer for each evidence technician. When you train someone to specifically do a job and perform it, I think it's returned three or four officers back to the road. Pendleton alone has destroyed over 1.5 tons of evidence. Thousands of firearms have been dispoed out. And I got to tell you, as a field supervisor, I'm not trained to handle all the intricate matters of evidence. It's a full-time specialty job, and by tasking some people to handle some of these sensitive issues that are actually trained to perform the job, it's been a huge relief for my operation.
Great, thank you. Follow-up?
Yes.
I think you told us how many troopers you supervise, but if you did, I didn't get the number down quick enough. Could you tell us again?
Sure, I'll give you a breakdown, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna. In the 16 counties, I have 14 field offices, and there are three other work sites that have troopers assigned that we don't have a physical office. Those are primarily rural, very rural locations. And within that, there's approximately 175 employees in four divisions. That would be forensics, patrol, fish and wildlife, and criminal investigative services or detectives. I am directly responsible for the facilities and the patrol officers in those region in those offices. With that, generally a station is a larger office. In my case, it's Bend, The Dalles, Pendleton, LeGrand, and Ontario. Each one of those will have a station is supervised by a lieutenant and two outposts assigned to those. Give an example of Bend. Bend would have be a lieutenant-run office that will have sergeant-run outposts at Madras and Prineville.
Thank you. Can I follow up here just for a moment? So you've heard this conversation about adding 139 new troopers. We've had this conversation. Superintendent of I and many of the others have. I don't mean to put you on the spot or in place of have you under your superintendent's shoulder there, but one of my concerns is that, one, we get these new folks out on the road, and two, that we do it with the least amount of added middle supervision possible. So I'm putting you on the spot to some degree, but can we put the 140 or 139 folks out there on the road scattered around the state? So you're talking about 14 offices, so 139, I don't know how many new officers you would get, but just in your opinion, how much more new supervision will it take to put those folks on the road? And I know we have some other policy option packages, but I'm just talking about getting troopers to the road. If you have 14 offices, could you add 28 troopers and not add a lieutenant in every one of those locations? Or give us a sense of that.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, the short answer is yes. We're prepared to handle that. I agree. It doesn't matter how many drivers you give us in the race. We don't have the pit crew, which is our troopers. We're not going to win the race. And so I've got the sergeants and lieutenants in place. It'll stretch us in some offices, like Ontario, for example. I have one sergeant to eight troopers, but he's also carrying evidence, fleet work. You remove some of those duties, and that sergeant gets to be a sergeant. Yes, we're ready to handle those men and women at the trooper ranks. So just to follow up, we already carry some sergeant vacancies, I think 5 to 7, and we intentionally are holding those numbers back until we have the troopers to justify those positions. You know, sergeant is a very versatile rank in our agency. You could serve as a program manager, a task force manager. At a larger patrol office, it's reasonable to have a sergeant supervise 7 to 9 troopers. But I look at my Grant County office, for example, in John Day, a sergeant would have only 5 troopers, but which on paper looks like maybe that position's not justified, but he's handled the evidence, buying the stationery, handling the clerical. And, there's one thing about the supervisors on our agency is we are patrol troopers first. I drive a police car. I have a radar in it. I come to work every day in a uniform. I just want to stress for my lieutenants and sergeants, these are patrol supervisors. But the short answer is yes, we're ready, and I don't think there's any plans, at least in my region, to add supervisors to those troopers.
Thank you.
Senator Winters and then Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Do you use or need canine units?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, yes and yes.
And is there a plan for expanding canine?
Right. You'll hear a lot of that about that. I know Senator Nelson had a chance to ride with a canine patrol. That's probably why you're focused on the interdiction aspect that day. But we use canines quite a bit. There's a huge demand nationally for canines. Quite frankly, they're hard to get after 9/11 because every agency needs them for everybody wants a Labrador to sniff something nowadays. But that's probably not the best way to term that. But we have in my division, our canines are they're an integral part of the work that we do. We also employ arson sniffing canines, and you'll hear probably more about that from our detective captain. But I think there are plans to increase the program. Right now we have a canine in Eastern Oregon and in the Dalles. We have a new one arriving. We have one in Pendleton, and they are a huge success. I mean, they're seizing bucket loads of unlawful drugs and more cash than and sometimes we say it's better to be lucky than good, but I think in this case we're being good because these guys are pulling a lot of drugs off the street with their dogs.
Thank you. I'm acting as chair temporarily. In the queue, we have Representative Cameron, followed by Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Captain Hamden, I've got a couple Labrador retrievers that would love to sniff some things out. They just pick up dead ducks now. I'm just curious. I wanted to follow up on the line of questions. You're talking about moving troopers who are bred to be on the road they're in evidence tech positions and moving them back out on the road with people who are specialized in that. And Superintendent, I heard you talk about we've transferred two troopers, one from Fish and Game and one from the road into HR. And I really want to hear more about, the 175 employees that you supervise that maybe we have, square pegs and round holes, and getting them in the right places where they belong, I think, is real important. Is there other people that you supervise that are troopers, they're qualified to be out on the road, that are pigeonholed in some place that they probably don't want to be or have to be?
Sure.
How many, out of that 175, maybe how many positions could you identify that could be pushed out onto the road?
Sure. Mr. Chair is back. Representative Cameron, we don't have anybody that's carrying a gun working for our department that's not performing the police function in Central Eastern Oregon. We do have sergeants at many work sites that are handling administrative duties. But one nice thing about being in OSP management, there's really no cap on the amount of hours a week I can work if I want to. So if usually I will handle my baseline duties, and then evidence would be a subsequent duty to my day. We don't have anybody that's reporting to work in a jumpsuit or in jeans handling evidence. Those duties are in addition to mentoring, reviewing work, passing down the directives, being on patrol. Quite frankly, a trooper seizes evidence, that sergeant will come in and log that evidence and go back out on patrol, and then the court will call and say we need to get rid of this evidence, and they'll put through those tasks. As far as our, I'll probably let the superintendent speak to statewide as far as training and recruiting, but I can tell you it's just better for us to have a police officer try to recruit police officers, and that's what we've done with some of our staff, two troopers, I think, that are assigned to the task full time. But all of us are recruiters. To meet this Project 200, there's not a single cop in this outfit that's not packing around a fistful of applications. But it's not a part of my day. I see I get my snow tires on with Schwab, and I see a good guy, I'll hand him an application. But I don't think you could say it's taking me off the road to do that. I didn't want to dance around your question, but I don't have any employees that are off patrol.
Just maybe follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And maybe this goes back to Superintendent McClain then. And I guess, I understand we're all recruiters, and I would preach that in my business, that we're all kind of recruiters and marketers and all that. But when we're talking about taking a couple people and put them in specialty positions, it concerns me, and you have a plan to get those people back out there, maybe hire some people who are professional HR people that I'm going to take a trooper with me to a recruiting class, obviously, that day, but are we training people to be troopers, and then they're being moved into places where they aren't productive in that way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the two troopers that were moved into the recruiting position, that was a difficult decision. I made that decision. And the decision was that I couldn't wait, even though there's a package, as I spoke to earlier, that addresses reestablishing our recruiting and hiring unit. But I felt I couldn't stand by and not have some active recruiting done previous to hopefully gaining some additional troopers. And those are the only two that I know of right now that are probably assigned to duties other than, in this case, a patrol function or fish and wildlife duties.
And Superintendent McClain, I'm not trying to criticize that decision. I understand you're being creative to make that. I just want to make sure that this committee, or that I have information available that I can support you and supply the right resources in the right place to get the job done that you need to get done, and I just want to make sure that that's talked about. Thank you.
I appreciate that. And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, as the captain when we talk about those folks that are handling evidence, unfortunately, he's correct. The sergeants and above that can work as many hours as they want, so to speak, they tend to end up putting in a lot of extra hours to get the job done. They try to maintain their supervision of their troops, and they'll come in and extend the hours out to get evidence work done, take care of the cars, whatever the case may be.
Thank you. Before we leave, and Captain Gregg, we're going to ask that you continue tomorrow. Senator Nelson, would you like to say that last
question? Distance is a big issue out there also. A couple sessions ago, we wanted to move the forensics laboratory from Pendleton down to Bend, and I had to tell the co-chair at that time that it was actually closer for us in Pendleton to drive to Portland than it was to drive to Bend. So you got to, I mean, the distance is a huge issue, and the chain of evidence is a very crucial one, as a specialized thing, as the captain said. And so we think, at least in our part of the country, we think in terms of big miles.
Just
very briefly, I appreciate you having troopers doing the recruiting, because I remember one time when I was, in fact, on the state police, they sent an old lieutenant to Portland State during the 60s to recruit, and it was just a disaster because you had an old man doing that. And then the other thing I'd say is that another big change in the state police from those days when I was there, the captains were old men and now they're young guys, so I don't know.
We'll send you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just one quick thing. We talk about the accidents. About every year, of course, we lose a number of officers nationwide. About 60% of those officers are lost in what they call accidents. It could be an auto accident where they're at the wheel. It could be a plane crash. It could be when they're outside the car and get hit by another car.
Thank you very much for your testimony and your service. Colleagues, I'm going to be back in Portland on personal business tomorrow. Senator Westland will be chairing the committee. And I just wanted to encourage you all to try to be diligent on being here on time. Susan will be calling all of your offices precisely at 3 o'clock to make sure that you're here. This meeting's adjourned.